Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. A reminder that we Zoomed the day before, so if something should happen on Wednesday night, we will not be discussing it till Friday. Before we introduce our first guest, who is an old friend and someone I totally admire and respect, I want to remind you that I've never met him, but someday I hope to. We hear the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. We've been doing this for months. We will continue to do this until the election of November 2020. I want his voice ringing in your ears as you exercise the franchise. I want you to remember what patriotism means. I want you to understand what talking truth to power means. And I also want you to embrace the idea that immigration has been such a vital part of America. It is what's made us great. It's what's brought diversity. It's what's brought, frankly, even an understanding of why democracy is so important. So now, the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Joining us, as he does on occasion, and I'm so grateful for it, is John Nichols. John Nichols is a prolific writer. He is one of the most thoughtful people I know. He is a great historian, so he's always looking back as we look at the present and then able to forecast the future, which is so important. John lives in Wisconsin. So not only is John a great writer at The Nation magazine, but he lives at a very, very important location. We've been following the issues in Kenosha. We know that President Trump went up to Kenosha and, of course, met not with the family that was so harmed by the police, but only with the police and some business owners that were obviously harmed by the riots and the unrest in Kenosha. But he also lives in Madison, Wisconsin. And John, as I was getting ready to bring you on the air, I saw a tweet that you had tweeted out about something that the Madison City Council was about to embrace, or in fact may have embraced last night. And it really relates to all the things that we've been talking about. It relates to racism, it relates to defund the police, it relates to the fact that we haven't gotten the leadership we need either from the president or frankly from members of the governor's office or the legislature. And yet, if we're not gonna get the leadership from on high, communities recognize that they must respond, and they must respond now because the moment is urgent. So let me welcome you to the program. And I don't know whether you want to begin with the bigger picture of Kenosha and the president, or you want to go to the micro picture of what happened in Madison. But as you pointed out just before we went on the air, they're connected and everything is connected right now because we're desperate for action and we take action where we can find it.
That's exactly right. And I appreciate that, Arnie. It's good to talk to you. I think starting a little bit with the big picture makes sense. And the reason I'd say so is that it's important in this moment where things move so very quickly that we don't lose sight of, you know, where a lot of the energy right now comes from. Of course, we go back to the killing of George Floyd in May. But then in the immediate aftermath of that, there was obviously a surge in protests, demonstrations, and demands. And there was a sense that we might move as a country, as a state, in cities. But frankly, there hasn't been sufficient movement. The House of Representatives did do the George Floyd policing reforms. They passed that, but the Senate has blocked it. In Wisconsin, there was an effort by the Democratic governor, Democratic lieutenant governor, to enact significant reforms in use of force, literal standards for use of force, that went right to the issues that we're talking about. And Republicans refused to even take them up because they control the legislature. They did nothing. Then 10 days ago in Kenosha, Wisconsin, a historic industrial city on the shores of Lake Michigan, south of Milwaukee, north of Chicago, on a Sunday evening, Jacob Blake, a 29-year-old black man, was going to his car. He was in some sort of interaction with the police, and we've seen videos of it. He was going to his car. A police officer grabbed his shirt and then shot him 7 times in the back. The video shocked everyone immediately. There were fires. There were buildings that were wrecked. Militias were rallied by right-wing forces, and white vigilantes showed up on the streets of the city with heavy weapons. They were allowed to roam the streets of the city by the police. And on Tuesday night, 8 days ago, 2 protesters were shot and killed by a 17-year-old white gunman who is associated with the militias, a vigilante by any measure, any way to say it. I give you only that history to tell you that on Monday of this week, the Wisconsin legislature again had a chance to take up those use of force standards, to pass legislation that has already been framed out, that's ready to go. The governor wants to sign it. People want to act. It's necessary action. And they did nothing. And so there's great frustration.
Remind my audience that the governor is a Democrat, but the legislature is controlled by Republicans. And given the behavior of Donald Trump, given what Donald Trump did just last night in Kenosha, again, I want to remind everyone that we taped this on Wednesday morning, that there's almost a code of silence. It's like you cannot respond to racism. You cannot respond to police action. You cannot do this. And what you see with the president is now actually translating into what's happening in the Wisconsin legislature.
Yeah, very much. In fact, I think that in the Wisconsin legislature, it's safe to say that the speaker of the legislature operates in a very Trumpian way. He's much more dignified in his language and in his presentation, but it's the same, and frankly, the same politics, this refusal to take up the fundamental issues. And also a very calculating approach to it all, one that does, you know, look toward division rather than any effort to do a bipartisan effort to find unity.
So John, just a second, I want to stop you. I did an interview yesterday with a Pulitzer Prize winning writer from Iowa, Art Cullen. Art wrote a piece at The Guardian, which is, by the way, phenomenal, about sort of what was happening in Iowa. But he used an interesting term that I want you to sort of think about, because I kind of borrowed some of his language. He referred to the governor of Iowa having a mind meld with Donald Trump. And as I use that with my governor, as I'm hearing you describe the Speaker of the House, that's an interesting way of approaching it, because that sort of creates the idea that even if he packages well and he seems to be more polite and he seems to be, you know, quote unquote, diplomatic, the mind meld tells you that whatever the result is, it is going to be a Trumpian result.
That's exactly right. Art is a very kind man, and I think a little too kind here. Mind meld suggests that people really are on the same page. I would suggest that there are Republican politicians who, frankly, simply see Trump as a vehicle to keep them in power. They might actually disagree with Trump on a whole bunch of things, might in another setting operate in different ways. But in this setting, they have allowed themselves to completely, you know, kind of go on the team, to join in and to become the Republican, a Republican party that is essentially an extension of Trump. And so at the core, however we explain this, we end up in the same place. It is a Trumpian result. And so there's this deep frustration in Wisconsin at this point. And the frustration is with the fact that you had an effort in early June to deal with these issues. As Todd Onstad, a state representative from Kenosha, says, they dealt precisely with the issues that were involved in the shooting of Jacob Blake. You literally had a situation where the legislature was offered bills that would establish standards for the use of force, saying you want to look for alternatives to shooting, you want to look for ways to dial down arguments, you want to have other officers at the scene intervene if they think officer is going to shoot when there might be alternatives. It was a very, very well-stated piece of legislation. And when you read it, you're just like, you can't guarantee it would have prevented the shooting of Jacob Blake. But you hold out that possibility. It's very real.
I mean, it's going to take time for any piece of legislation to filter through the system, for people to begin to learn the new terms of art, for people to learn to behave quickly. It's not right. A switch. We're yeah. all human. I mean, I get that. But if nothing else, it sets the statement of understanding. This is what we expect. And then you turn to the police chief, you turn to the mayor, and you say, are you having a conversation with your cops? Are you having a conversation with your community? And at least we're all working off the same page. But if that page doesn't exist, then you create the situation you saw in Kenosha.
Well, and you had, and also remember, you had 2 months, more than 2 months. So I know it takes time for things to filter down. Right. But the fact is that had there been action in June, at the very least, and again, I'm not saying it would have prevented it. What I'm saying is at the very least, we'd have people thinking about this and perhaps having second thoughts about how they operate and how they do it. But more importantly than that, we'd have an avenue for accountability. Right. We could say, well, these standards have been established. They were not followed. So all of this is important, and all of it didn't happen. And again, on Monday of this week, it didn't happen. The legislature called into special session, literally gaveled in and gaveled out, i.e. they just simply showed up and said, we're not going to do anything, and then didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. So amidst all this frustration with President Trump, you know, flying in to do what Gwen Moore, congresswoman from Milwaukee, said was, you know, film a campaign commercial. His visit to Kenosha wasn't to heal the community. He didn't meet with Jacob Blake's family. He didn't condemn vigilante violence. No, he came in to get pictures taken in front of rubble and to actually lie about the mayor and do all sorts of other things that were, you know, crassly political. So what a bad day it was, except that in Madison, Wisconsin, that night, a marathon session that lasted, you know, the better part of 10 hours, the Madison City Council finally, and not to try to make people heroes here, they didn't act as quickly as they should have, but they finally enacted long proposed legislation to establish a police auditor, i.e. a monitor, somebody who will be in a full-time position to look at the police department with the ability to get police records, to issue subpoenas, to examine practices, to create reports, to make recommendations, and then to create a 13-member police oversight board made up of citizens with representation, with an emphasis on representation from communities that have been historically dispossessed and also historically had challenges with the police department. And so there really was an affirmative effort to start to put structures in place that might deal with some of these issues. It's not the first city to do it. Other cities across the country have done it. But there's a model here for action at the local level. And that's a very big deal. I want to emphasize how significant this is on many levels. People were at the city council session till 4 a.m. from the community saying, and this was a community-driven initiative, saying this has to happen. Now, I don't want to be naive or overly optimistic here and tell you every problem's been solved. It hasn't by a long distance. This is really just an initial step. It is on a day when Donald Trump is reemphasizing how hard it is to get things done, how hard it is to get the right thing done. A day after the Wisconsin legislature reemphasized how hard it is to get things done, how hard it is to get the right thing done. Here you have at the local level, city council members doing the right thing.
So let me just read something from the op-ed that was written, or the editorial that was written in the Madison paper. And that it said, it extends from suggestions made by the California-based OIR group, which studied the Madison Police Department and the city's ad hoc committee. It has community support and buy-in. It has the potential to build trust between the police department and the community, which they said was vital. So one of the reasons I'm reading this, John, is that this isn't a case of first impression in Madison. Madison obviously hired someone, and they didn't hire someone on Sunday. This was a report that, you know, been done years or maybe months before. How do I say this? I love this idea. When I was in the New Hampshire legislature, do you know what job I really wanted? I didn't want the job of governor. I wanted a new job, the job of public advocate. That was the title of the job I wanted. And that was an opportunity for people to bring their concerns, for us to have a level of transparency, for us to investigate concerns. For frankly, in this case, you know, the police come too. It's not just about the public. It's not just about underserved communities. It's the police have a place to come too. Trust isn't a one-sided bridge. It's a two-sided bridge. And you need to create it that way, John. And so as I was reading this, I couldn't stop but smile, because that's really what we need. We need a place where we can come and say, this is what I think is wrong. Investigate this, give us the transparency, so then we can figure out what the policies are that bring about the stability for both sides.
And I've written a lot about this in a number of settings. I'm very interested in these civilian review boards and in oversight boards. I think the most important thing is that they have a budget. Yeah. They've got to have resources.
Right.
These monitors have to have resources as well. Madison did provide them a substantial amount, almost $500,000, I believe. I want to look at that figure to be precise. My view is that ultimately these oversight boards should be elected. There should be a model, and it's hard in our current politics. There should be models to assure that they are truly representative, especially of communities that have been ill-served. The idea of having them have that smoldy democratic legitimacy, i.e. that they are there as elected public advocates, like the New York City public advocate, a role that I think is significant on a number of levels. And so I'm interested in that. I'm interested in the fact that in the United Kingdom, increasingly they elect police chiefs, which is not some sort of radical notion. In the United States, we elect sheriffs across the country.
We elect judges with the consequences that aren't so positive.
I know.
Remember that. Let's remember.
No. I'm cautious when I talk about this, because I do want people to think about all the challenges and the complexities. But what I'm saying is that I think as a country, from the highest level in Washington down through the state level to the local level, we have undervalued oversight. We have undervalued the role of, you know, monitoring what our public agencies, what our, particularly our policing agencies, do.
And when we don't do oversight, we lay the foundation for it to be repeated over and over and over again. Because if actions don't have consequences, if we don't look back at what is sort of the underpinnings of this failure, and we recognize it to try to rectify it, then we've just set it up to fail again. I mean, that's really what the problem is. What's really interesting, John, is that I'm having a woman who's going to be calling us in from Germany. She wrote a piece to Christian Science Monitor talking about the high youth unemployment rate. Well, the high youth unemployment rate in the article, the Christian Science Monitor, will lead to, guess what? Potential gang violence, will lead to unrest, will lead to all the things that we're talking. So just having an oversight isn't enough. But
no,
maybe if the oversight can begin to say, look at these pockets of failure. These pockets of failure happen over and over again. If we are going to have less work to do with oversight, we have to deal with the poverty issue or the education issue or the unemployment issue. And we actually have to target those things, because those things actually will make a difference so that the pressure on the police and on the community is eased. That's our job. Mm-hmm.
Well, and remember, if we accept, as we should, that there is structural racism, then why wouldn't we look for structural responses? Why wouldn't we look for responses that look at this in a big way, but also a deep way, and that are ongoing, that doesn't say, oh, well, you know, we'll pass a bill and then it'll be all dealt with. No, you establish entities that keep on an issue. The other thing that I would emphasize here is that oversight is not always negative, i.e. that it isn't just to catch the wrongdoer, although that is an important value of it. Mm-hmm. Oversight can also be very positive. It can work with agencies and individuals within those agencies to do the right thing, to establish best practices, to have that flexibility. Keith Ellison, the Attorney General of Minnesota, when I talked to him about, you know, all of these issues, made a really good point. And that was that in police departments now, there is often a fear on the part of people who want to speak out, who want to say something's being done wrong here. This department isn't working the right way, or someone did do something that was wrong. And they're afraid to speak out because they don't really see necessarily that change will come.
I think what people don't understand is these oversight boards are also a place where you can clone good ideas, where you can clone good results. I mean, I'm going to say something really quirky, but it's an elementary school across the street. So I saw the kindergarten teacher at the elementary school, and here's what they're doing, because they closed school. It's all going to be online, but they're going to be teaching from their classroom. So teacher is going into their classroom, so there'll be this illusion of a class. She is going to be standing in front of the board. She's a kindergarten teacher. She'll be showing the kids what their desks look like, the whole dog and pony show, so they feel like they're in school. So here's what I said to her. What can I do to help you? Every Friday, Arnie is going into the elementary school, into the kindergarten class, sitting in the rocking chair in the kindergarten class, dressing up in costume and reading them a book.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, but the reason I'm telling you this is that I posted it on Facebook. And I said to them, call your school. Talk to your teachers. What can you do? This is a good idea. Let's clone it. What you're pointing about with the oversight board is that not only are they a dumping ground for grievance, but they can also be a place to celebrate success. And if we can let people know that, then I think people will even trust it more, because they'll know that when they've done something right, and that's important.
It's really important. And I think that's the vital reality. And so oversight, you know, I learned about oversight, and we don't talk about it enough. I love that we're doing this right now. Oversight in this circumstance has become a big deal, and people are paying attention to it in cities across the country. There is an effort to step it up, but oversight's nothing new. And one of my favorite stories comes from an old acquaintance of mine who's now passed, Gaylord Nelson, who was the longtime senator from Wisconsin. When Gaylord Nelson was in the U.S. Senate in the 1960s into the 1970s, he held a 9-year-long oversight committee session. He kept it open for 9 years on pharmaceutical industry and on drugs and drug manufacturers, and a tremendous amount of challenge to wrongdoing occurred, but also legislation was generated out of that 9-year-long oversight hearing. It was a consumer, the best way to say it is it's broader than even drug policy. It's a consumer oversight hearing. And what I'm saying is that's how we ought to think about it. If we think about again, going back to the 60s, if you think about the Fulbright hearings on the Vietnam War, that was oversight by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee looking at the conduct of the Vietnam War as the war was going on. And frankly, it raised fundamental questions that I think helped to define the anti-war movement.
And let's kind of look what's happened under the Trump administration, because when you realize what these regulatory agencies are, whether it's the EPA, whether it's the SEC, he has defanged them. He has told them not to regulate. He's told them to look the other way. And in the end, that produces the instability. That produces the corruption. So we do embrace. That's essential to democratic institutions, is to have the concept of oversight. What I think is interesting about what Madison did, and now we're seeing with lots of cities, is they're bringing that concept of oversight to a much more micro level. And in the end, if you can begin to resolve things at the city level and the town level, not only does that create the sort of level of stability, because that's the thing that touches me first. Mm-hmm. State government touches me as quickly as Concord touches me. And I think that if you can see a sense of responsiveness at your city level, then you want to see it sort of trickle up, because you've seen how effective it is and how it works.
That's right. What we're seeing now in police oversight is that there are networks of city oversight boards that are forming. They're literally becoming a coalition, if you will. There are also networks of monitors and auditors for policing that are forming. We're going to have best practices and best ideas shared across cities and across counties nationwide. This is not the alternative to the bigger, deeper structural changes that need to occur as regards funding, budgets, a lot of stuff like that. But it is a vehicle by which the alternatives may develop. And so I find it very exciting. And you know, look, this has been an incredibly devastating 10 days, horrifying and jarring. And I don't want to begin to suggest to you that we're out of it, because we're not. But I can tell you that of all the deeply frustrating realities that have been in play over the last 10 days and revelations and pain, here you have some people that said, you know, yeah, in this moment, we're going to do something. These council members did do the right thing. They were prodded by the community. And so, you know, it is how democracy is supposed to work.
And John Nichols, the right thing wasn't pointing a finger of blame. The right thing was finding a way to come together, to figure out together how to address the issues. It's not you're right and I'm wrong. It's let's come together, let's be transparent, let's have a conversation, let's understand what's going on. And from that understanding, then we can begin to fix it. And I think right now what Donald Trump does better than anyone is he plays the blame game. He plays the blame game. And usually the blame is only on one side and not the other, so he's not willing to share it. And what I think these kinds of groups are doing in places like Madison is sort of opening it up and allowing the conversation to happen and allowing everyone to come to the table. We've got to do it. That's how trust gets created. Absolutely. John Nichols, this is a good story. Despite the fact that the backdrop is such a challenging story because of what's going on in Kenosha and Wisconsin and Portland and everywhere else, let's hope that we get resolution after the election of November 2020. And resolution is just the beginning of the story. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Ciao. John Nichols writes for Nation Magazine. We love having him. Anyway, this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. We will be right back.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. 24-year-old Tyler Gillette of Ohio has cared about environmental issues since he was young. And growing up, he says that sometimes made him feel like an outcast among his conservative peers.
Everyone would call me a liberal or a tree hugger or a hippie. I thought I was the only one out there that had conservative values that cared about the environment.
But Gillette was not deterred. In college, he studied environmental science, and he began advocating for free market solutions to climate change, for example, by writing an op-ed for a student publication. That op-ed caught the attention of national climate organizers. Soon, the leaders of Republic EN, a group that advocates for market-driven climate solutions, invited Gillette to join their group. And the Citizens Climate Lobby asked him to come to a lobbying event in D.C. Gillette says meeting with legislators for the first time was empowering.
I felt like I was participating in democracy. You know, I was playing an actual role.
Through these experiences, Gillette says he's found other like-minded conservatives.
Now I know that I'm not the only one that sees things the way that I do.
So he encourages others to speak up too. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Had to be a big shot, did you? You had to open up your now. You had to be a big shot, didn't you? All your friends were so knocked out. You had to have the last word last night. So much fun to be around. You had to have the white hot spotlight. You had to be a big shot.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder that we Zoom on Wednesday. If our conversation feels a bit dated because something happens Wednesday night, that will explain it. So as many of you know from my audience, the Christian Science Monitor and the Wall Street Journal were the two papers that my father read to me every single night practically before I went to bed. So instead of the green fairy tale book or the red fairy tale book, it was the Christian Science Monitor and it was the Wall Street Journal. I am now 66 years old. I on occasion go to the Wall Street Journal, but I always go to the Christian Science Monitor because I actually value the work that it does. And I'm looking at the monitor and I see this article. And the article was entitled, "Young Workers Hit Hardest in Global Downturn. What's the Answer?" And a series of different reporters worked on this, and I managed to grab one of them, Lenora Chu. She covers Europe out of Berlin for the Christian Science Monitor. She is an author and longtime journalist who got her start covering the Minnesota state capitol and Jesse Ventura, the body and the mind, Jesse Ventura's single term as governor. So she's had 15 years of experience in U.S. and China, and she reports on the intersection of politics, education, and culture. She has actually written a book that I don't think we're going to get to this time called Little Soldiers. I definitely want to bring you back to talk about education in China, since that's where my daughter lives. She's married to a young man from China. She's about to have a baby, and education in China is what she does, Lenora. So
that's amazing.
When I saw the book, I'm like, oh my God, we got to bring you back. But what's interesting for me is that as I'm looking at what the monitor was reporting on, it was really reporting on the fact that not only are we dealing with issues of schooling for young people, but what happens when either schools are not opening or people are leaving school at a time of a pandemic where job opportunities have basically vanished.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we need to be worrying about. You know, there's obviously the immediate health issues that arise from a global pandemic, but some of the young people graduating into this job market, the research has shown that coming into a recession at a very young age, ready to enter the job market, those diminished opportunities last for a really long time, decades, if you're unlucky.
What this story kind of does is it points to that dilemma and says, you know, we've seen it with the Great Recession or whatever in 2008, 2009, but that was, how do I say this? That was a terrible situation, but it didn't involve physical distancing. It didn't involve fear of death. Now, you might have had a financial death, but you didn't have all those other things that also add to the complications of what's happening in finance. And because new businesses aren't even thinking of opening, people are shuttering, people aren't knowing what the future is like. Everyone is reluctant to even run the risk of a hire. So this is like the recession on steroids, because of all the complications and we're not knowing when, quote unquote, it will end. And you can't just write a check to fix it, which is what we were able to do, at least in the United States, by bailing out Wall Street. Then we sort of fixed it. Tell me what we see happening in different countries, because this is an international pandemic. Everyone is facing something somewhat similar around the globe, but the response to it has been very different.
Sure. You know, this was the story that you referenced was a multi-effort reported by several people, including myself. I can talk about China first, because obviously I lived there for 10 years until recently. And China has a unique situation of graduating almost 8-9 million people every year into a job market that already could not find enough jobs for these people. So add on top of that, you have a pandemic, you have the manufacturing sector slowing down, the services sector, which was really catching up with manufacturing. You know, we're used to thinking of China as the world's factory floor. You know, they make our sneakers, they assemble our iPhones. But in fact, the service sector there to serve the growing middle class, that is actually a really important sector. And those jobs are also disappearing because of the pandemic. So they have a lot to really watch out for there. And I do worry about that new generation. They have particular challenges coming into this pandemic.
So how is the government of China responding to that? Because again, you have an authoritarian government, which, you know, doesn't need permission, just does. As they're looking at sort of an economy that's a little bit more fragile, something they're not necessarily used to, they're looking at this burgeoning population, they're looking at these young people coming into the workforce unemployed. You don't want unrest with young people, that you know. You would think that at least the government would say, okay, what kind of tasks can we give them so that they at least have some form of employment? They have connection to the workforce. They're also earning a living. So is the Chinese government actually focusing on this problem, unlike the United States that is ignoring it?
Sure. You know, one thing that China's always done, and this has always been a sort of a go-to, is try to get all of these urban graduates to go out to rural areas, you know, whether it's in education, because rural education is terribly understaffed and underfunded, or now medicine, say, right? So they have these new programs where they're removing regulations and allowing kids to go into the countryside to work in various capacities. Whereas before it was a bit harder, now it's easier. And they're saying, hey, come out here. And they've always done that for teachers even, you know, with salary boosts, with promises of professional development. If you go work at an under-resourced, understaffed rural school, then we have all kinds of things for you. So that's one thing that they're doing to try to solve this problem.
Well, you know, Leonard, I'm thinking about this. I live in a sort of a relatively rural area. Concord, New Hampshire is like 30,000 or 40,000. But I mean, my state is fairly rural compared to like New York City and Boston. What I am seeing is a lot of people fleeing urban areas and, you know, buying up anything in, you know, my state and places where it is clearly less dense. Given the pandemic, has it been easier now for the Chinese government to convince some of these new young graduates to go back? You know, they were never born there, but maybe their relatives were born there, to go back to rural China, to begin to bring the education and the medicine there. Because in a lot of ways, people now see a different problem with urban areas, which used to be the place of opportunity. But when it comes to a pandemic, it also becomes an opportunity for spread.
You know, Arnie, your question shows that you know China very, very well. It was a really intelligent question, because for decades, China's been trying to get young people to move into cities because that's where all the jobs were. You know, is there going to be a reverse migration? That's a really great question. I think for half a year, there have been people sheltering with their families at home, living under the same roof, just like we were in the U.S. Whether that's going to last, let's see. I mean, most of the reports that I'm hearing is that China is pretty much open for business again. My friends, they're sending their kids back to school 100% with, you know, social distancing and masking, but a lot of that stuff is revving back up. I think what's been slower to come back is consumer spending. And I think that the Chinese consumer, which had a terror of spending on luxury goods and everything, you know, is the largest market for everything from automobiles to mobile phones. I think that's going to be slower to come back because the Chinese, frankly, are very practical people. They've been scared back into saving. So, yeah.
And they had that history. So they had that ethic, you know, this sort of commercialization, the buying ethic, that was sort of something that they kind of looked at what we were doing, you know, whether they wanted to buy a McDonald's, whether they wanted Kentucky Fried Chicken, or whether they wanted to sort of consume. That was kind of like, oh, that's what they were doing in America. That must be the good life. And now, given the nature of the pandemic, I think they're beginning to say, let's be a little bit more sober here. Let's not spend every dollar we get, or in this case, their level of activity when it comes to bringing in money. As I'm listening to you talk about this, I also think that there's something else about China that in a way I'm a little bit jealous of. And I'm going to tell you about an interview I did many, many months ago. And it was right at the very beginning of the pandemic in the United States of COVID. And I interviewed a group of reporters from Kaiser Health. They were talking about people in Chinatown in California and that how they've been wearing masks for a long time. And we were being told not to wear masks. They were concerned because they didn't want these Asians to sort of be pointed to because look at the mess they're wearing, yada, yada, yada. But that's part of their culture. That's also what they saw coming from China, that mask wearing is sort of, it's sort of just, that's what you do in the morning, you put your mask on. And so I'm looking at how their ability to respond to the pandemic, they already had an edge on the rest of the world because they were wearing, I mean, my daughter has five different kinds of masks depending on the pollution in the air, you know?
Sure.
To a large extent, they were more prepared to respond because they were already comfortable with the concept of masks. They're already prepared to respond with an economic downturn because they know how to save.
This young Chinese generation is only one generation removed from, honestly, a lot of poverty, right? China was a very poor country up until 10, 20 years ago. So, and on the masks, you're right. We moved from Shanghai to Berlin. We had air filters. We had hospital grade air filters. We bought every kind of new mask that came onto the market. That's what you do to sort of survive and thrive there. And you're absolutely right. There's a, you know, when an Asian person looks at a mask, it's not politically charged.
No.
Like it has become in the US. It's just something that helps keep you safe.
I so learned that when I went to visit my daughter in Shanghai. I mean, the day that I was supposed to land in China, you're going to love this, Lenora. They had to actually divert the plane to Beijing because there was an inversion and it was so polluted, the plane could not land.
Sure.
Could not land. And yes. Virgin Air kept apologizing because it had never happened in its history because it was like the worst air pollution in human history. And I'm thinking, wow, where am I going?
Was this 2013?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember. Airpocalypse, we call
it. Yes, Airpocalypse. That was my husband died in 2013. 2 weeks later, I'm on a plane. Yep. My daughter says, come visit me. That was the day that I could not land in 2013. So you know exactly what I'm talking about. But in a lot of ways, it's given them an edge. And we see the mask as political. We're seeing it as resentful. We can't imagine how you survive wearing something covering our face. But there it is, just part of it's just part of living. In a way, it's sad because it was done because of pollution, but look at how much more prepared they were to deal with this pandemic, which is all about covering your nose and covering your face. Now let's go to Germany, because I thought the German response is also interesting about how they're looking at what they're doing with youth unemployment, because in the end, as I look at all these different countries responding, the fact that the U.S. is basically doing niente makes me even angrier.
Sure. Now, Germany is a special case. I always feel badly comparing Germany to the U.S. because I feel like we're starting from a different ground floor here in Germany with the social safety. No, it's definitely a worthy conversation to have. But, you know, it's like when I go to the doctor here, I'm not afraid that I'm one diagnosis away from not being able to make, you know, a rent payment or a mortgage payment. You know, the first time I went to the doctor here, including laboratory tests, it was something like the equivalent of $60. And I looked and I gaped at the bill and the doctor said, yep, not scary to go to the doctor here because he knows I'm coming from the U.S. system. And the social safety net, you know, youth unemployment is something like 5% in Germany right now compared to the U.S. We're talking mid-20s, right? At the worst during the pandemic, it's starting to come down a little bit, but 5% versus 26%. That's insane. You know, I think that German public policy has really tackled unemployment well. They have a program called short-term work. So instead of giving people money, although they've done that, they have sent money directly to individuals' bank accounts. What they've also done is subsidized companies' payrolls so they don't have to do mass layoffs just to stay afloat. So that's their approach. And I think it keeps people fed and housed. And that's been the priority of their public policy.
I mean, we're seeing so much unrest and we're seeing the idea that we're politicizing the mask. Everyone's trying to figure out, do you trust the doctors? Do you not trust the doctors? Do you trust the science? Do you trust the politicians? What's happening with this unemployment? But your mentioning of the safety net is so important here, Lenore. I've always been a big single payer person. I believe in not just affordable higher ed, but basically higher ed that's relatively free. Like it used to be in California, it was like a couple hundred bucks to go to college in California. Now everything has changed because it's become less available because you can't even imagine not only buying the books, but paying for the coursework. So I'm looking at Germany, and I think what people don't understand is the level of emotional stability that is produced as a result of that safety net. So not only are you concerned here about losing your job, but you are concerned about all the consequences of losing that job because you have to buy daycare. You have to buy healthcare. You have to buy all these things. And in those countries, that's a right. That's kind of across the board. So losing your job is devastating, no question. But it isn't the kind of shell shock that it is here where suddenly your level of vulnerability just adds to, I think, the chaos in your life.
Absolutely. I mean, think about the fact that health insurance is tied to your job in the US, right? I mean, Obamacare tried to change some of that, but in Germany, it's separate. So most people have public health insurance aside from their employment. So when you decouple that, it feels a little bit less, you know, precarious when you don't have work. Germany's COVID response, I remember how markedly different in early March when Chancellor Angela Merkel, who's the equivalent of the US president, came on and said, look, and by the way, she's got a PhD in physical chemistry. She's a scientist.
So she kind of likes science is what you're telling
right,
me.
Right,
right?
Yeah, so she has a very rational mind and she comes on and says, look, this is very serious. It's possible that 60% of Germans will get this virus and we need your help to get through this. And everybody said, oh, okay, you know, what should we do? And she didn't sugarcoat anything. And she also trusted the population to understand what she was talking about.
Let me just go back to the safety net you pointed out. Because, you know, we're going to be pointing in, you know, Donald Trump is in denial. He's already post-pandemic as far as he's concerned. And of course, my mantra has been over and over again, Lenora, that the pandemic is the economy. The pandemic is the economy. And until you address the pandemic, you're not going to be able to address the economy. You're not going to be able to open schools. If that is what you have to focus on, the pandemic, pandemic, pandemic. But one of the problems that we're having, and again, I'm going to go point to what's going on in Germany with your safety net. And that is not only were you more aware of responding effectively to the pandemic, and you've dealt with it much better than the United States. You've dealt with unemployment and turning the economy back on. One of the things we've learned here is that you might survive COVID-19, but you might have long-term health consequences. And that is even more frightening for a healthcare system that has looked like a piece of Swiss cheese anyway, and cost right. more than anyone else. And you're not sure whether you're gonna be able to go to a doctor when you're sick, and you're not gonna be able to sure you can afford it. And you have to figure out whether you're in network or out of network. So as I'm looking at not only the stability that you're seeing happening in Germany, but that stability of that healthcare system is gonna be even more valuable given what we know about with long-term consequences of COVID-19.
Sure, I mean, if you think about the strength of the public health system here, how it relates to everything. You know, do you even get tested? If you're afraid you're going to get $1,000 test bill, you're not going to go in, right? And here it's like, okay, it's going to be reasonable or it's going to be free. And not only that, one of the things Germany is looking at when they decide whether to open up is the capacity of hospital ICUs. So that's actually a metric that they look at. Are we going to go back into lockdown? Or are we going to continue to stay open? Oh, okay, we have capacity in our ICU, so I think we're going to be safe. And so it's such a reasonable approach that they have, I think, to whether to lock down and reopen. And because, think about it, if you're an individual person living here and you feel the government has control of things, that if there's an infection at a school, a mobile testing unit will show up, test everybody in the classroom and start contact tracing right away. That gives you confidence to go out and travel and spend money and go to a restaurant and send your kids to school. And it's all related to the economy humming, right? So I think just as you said, it's completely related, the pandemic and the economy.
I keep asking people, I wish I knew that people were doing tabletop exercises. Not only do I want to know my government has my back, but that the government has actually said, what happens here? What happens there? This is what we've done. This is what we anticipate. It makes me feel like the government does understand what's going on. And it creates a level of trust. Right now in the United States, it's just pure chaos, which is what makes it so frightening. But Leonard, because you're in Germany, I'm gonna go off script from the article. What about the whole issue of vaccines? Vaccines, again, has become a very political issue in the United States. Whether we can trust the vaccine has become a very political issue. There are 120 vaccines being looked at around the world. How is Germany talking about vaccines versus the kind of craziness we're seeing in the US?
Yeah, you know, I think a big difference, I think Donald Trump said recently that they were going to have something, you know, before the election, or they're going to push something through. I mean, that's purely political. I think Chancellor Merkel has said, you know, we're in this for the long haul. Just last week, she said, we're going to be living with this virus for a very long time. I'm worried it's starting to tick up again. And those numbers actually went down just in the last few days. But she's like, look, I'm not going to, you know, sugarcoat this. A vaccine is a ways away, and we're going to be living with this virus for quite a while. So let's just get used to it and be responsible.
Just hearing what you're saying makes me feel better. In a lot of ways, it's sobering. I don't want to have to live with this for a long time. I don't. Nobody does. But I want someone to be honest with me, because if at least they're honest with me, then I can sort of plan my life. whatever that's going to look like. But I feel like I'm, you know, you're getting all these mixed messages and it's horrifying. So again, since you're in Germany, I'm going to sort of pick your brain. One of the other things that we're hearing about, because the whole idea of the vaccine and whether you can trust the vaccine and whether it goes through enough testing is a matter of time. And they really do need time if they're going to administer this, not only to millions of people, but they don't get people sick once they administer this vaccine. So there has to be a level of trust. Are they talking in Germany about virtually home testing? You can test every day. The test costs a buck. And that in a lot of ways, what a lot of doctors are saying, at, for example, the Chan School of Public Health at Harvard, is that if you could have that kind of seamless, everyday, cheap testing all the time, in a way, it's not necessarily the equivalent of a vaccine, but it does actually provide the kind of stability you need to go back to school and to open an economy if you can do that just virtually every day at relatively no cost.
Sure. You know, the Robert Koch Institute, who's in charge of Germany's coronavirus response, they actually put the formula for the test online and encouraged labs around Germany to make their own tests. So immediately you had thousands of laboratories, you know, gearing up to offer tests. And that's how they've been able to have enough capacity. Now, the tests are actually pretty cheap. I've seen prices of anywhere from €5, you know, in US dollars, about $5 to $7 to up to $25. And you take it home and you do the swab at home and then you send it into the lab. And it usually takes about 24 to 48 hours, best case scenario. So that rapidity of response is incredibly important. You know, if you're having to wait 4 to 7 days to get your test results back, then that's not good.
So we were talking about youth unemployment. And another part of the story, I think, was that they went to Colombia. Is that correct? And again, the responses in different countries is so interesting because they're actually aware of this high spike in youth unemployment. They understand that that drives instability in a country. I always used to say, I used to do criminal justice work in the legislature, and I used to say what I would love to do is take young men, excuse me, between the ages of like 17 and 28 and hermetically seal them. Because virtually all those young men between 17 and 28, those are the ones that went to prison, okay? Those are the ones that went to trouble. And if I could get them to pass to 28 and get them to 29, I'd be golden. I could empty out all my prisons. But all the sort of frustrations of youth, of the lack of employment, of the lack of stability, of gang violence, of being influenced by things that are not necessarily positive, all those things seem to happen in that decade, that period. And yet, given the pandemic, you would think that this is the one group that you would work overtime at making sure that they have a sense of stability and hope.
Absolutely. You know, I spoke with an economist in the U.S. and she was frustrated that the U.S. is doing absolutely nothing to tackle youth unemployment. So she's a labor economist. And, you know, I think it is devastating because of those long-term effects. And it's not only just for this, we're talking about generations of people that we might need to figure out how to support later on. It's so much cheaper to do it on the front end. And I think, you know, U.S. public policy could be taking notes. They should be taking notes from somewhere, right? It doesn't have to be Germany. It doesn't have to be Colombia or China, but they should be taking notes from somewhere. And it just seems what I'm more concerned about also is just this disconnect between who's doing well in the pandemic and who isn't. And it seems like there's a group of people that are, you know, their house values are through the roof. You know, they've bumped up even more after COVID and the stock market's high. And if you are in the stock market or the housing market, and you have a professional job you can do at home, you're doing pretty well. But what about everybody else? And, you know just as well as I, if not better, that this is going to be a problem that will last for a really long time.
Well, and it's not only going to last for a long time, but the other article, the other point in your article is that if you experience this lack of access to employment after graduating, whether it's graduating from college or graduating from high school, that not it has a short-term impact on your income capacity, but it also has a potentially long-term impact on your income capacity. So this is not just devastating for the moment. This is not just a sense of frustration that you can't find a job. You can't find a job within your job skill, for example. It may not, that field may not be open, that field may be shut to you, but it is financially, it's going to impact you when you're 30 and when you're 40 and when you want to start a family. And again, another reason to make this investment now is that if you make this investment now, the level of income stability going on, which we're going to depend on as a country because we're going to tax them. And if they don't have income, there's nothing to tax. And then they can't have those investments in their infrastructure and their schools. I mean, it's like we don't understand the connections that are being made.
That's very well put. Can you write to your local congressman?
I know, it's like your knee bone is connected to your thigh bone. You know, right. I mean, the fact that, but this is the difference between, I think, places like Germany, places like Canada, places like the UK, EU, is that I think the motto of America is not a good one. And the motto of America is, you're on your own, Jack.
Yes.
And that was fine when it was the Wild West. That was fine when it was the wagon train. That was fine when, you know, you were your own farm, you were all your own energy source, you were your own. And then you could sort of see that you sort of created your world, and being on your own, Jack, made sense. But now we're living in such a complicated environment. Now we're much more dependent on each other. Now we need to have access to the internet and all these things that you can't do only on your own. And yet that's still the ethic. And that ethic is so failing us. And as you're describing what's happening in Germany and the fact that they're even aware of issues that we have ignored tells you why the level of instability here is only going to grow unless we address it.
Sure. And you know, one thing that Germany is doing is the vocational program, which actually is responsible for 2/3 of employment in Germany. You know, this is training. Oftentimes, this is people not outside of the university system, but training to become a mechanic or all kinds of jobs actually go through the vocational program. Germany has decided to prop this program up with funding. And that's what they're doing to try to tackle youth unemployment. So,
well, I got to let you go. But I'm just telling you, you're coming back to talk about education in China. I'm going to make you come back. I am beyond curious about it. And I think everyone is curious because China is the big footprint on the planet. And we need to not only understand its politics, we need to understand its educational systems, because again, they're going to have an enormous influence, not just on Asia, but on the rest of us. Lenora Chu covers Europe out of Berlin for the Christian Science Monitor. She is an author and a longtime journalist who got her start covering the Minnesota State Capitol and Jesse Ventura's single term as governor. You need to know I went to St. Olaf College. My friend was the Secretary of State in Minnesota when Jesse, the body and mind Ventura, won. I talked to her the day before the election. And I predicted Jesse would win.
Amazing.
And she looked at me and said, no way. Just to let you know, the magic happened here. Thank you so much for joining
me. Thanks for having me. Cheers, Arnie. Bye-bye.
It's a pleasure. All right, everyone. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. The producer is Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.